Sometimes you watch a movie and it just stays with you. It isn't one that you suggest when people ask you, what's a good scary movie, which we often get asked. It isn't one that you think of often, but when you do, you remember it fondly, even if you don't know what you particularly liked about it. When you go back and revisit it, there are two things that could happen. You might find that it was as good as you thought it was, or you might find something more to it relating to current social climates when you watch it again. While there are flaws, Session 9 still holds up. Session 9 takes place firmly in Massachusetts at the Danvers State Mental Hospital. So this week, we've asked our friend and Massachusetts native, Sean Thompson, to join us. He also has a book out right now and a little flash piece that we're going to talk about.
Yeah. Sean is from Massachusetts. He's got a BA in English from the University of Massachusetts. His Twitter, if our listeners, they should be well aware of Miskatonic Musings. Spooky Sean T. Also mentioning that, we were recently on Miskatonic Musings for Carriers and Red Rain, that episode. Although I guess the episode titles... the episode titles always get a little fuzzy because it's taken from a line from the show. I think that one was Shit Your Pants and Keep Moving.
Something about that.
Okay, but back to the point. You can find Sean's work at SeanMThompsonFiction.com, and he's all over Amazon, so name search will bring you his work.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With every episode, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers.
So, hey, Sean, welcome.
Hi, how's it going? Good to be here.
How are things in Massachusetts? Because we are Skyping from New York to Massachusetts.
Massachusetts is... It's finally starting to feel like fall. It was a little weird for a couple weeks where it was still like 80, 90 degrees. You could tell like the trees didn't really know what to do. Like they finally just started turning red. But like, you know, a few weeks back, it'd be like some of them were red and then some of them are still green because they're like, well, it's still 80 degrees, so I'm not going to turn yet.
Yeah, it was starting to feel a little creepy just as far as like, hey, where's global warming taking us?
I just assumed I was going to sweat until it snowed.
I've kind of talked about, yeah, the seasons are abrupt now. It goes kind of from summer to winter, winter to summer.
I'm going
to
have a heart attack of heat, and then I'm going to just freeze to death.
I deliver Meals on Wheels to the elderly, and I had a woman astutely say, we go straight from summer to winter now. And I was like, oh my God, you're right. Yeah. So it goes from like 90 degrees to like 20 degrees.
Excellent. Now, do you get where you're from, do you get the people, what are they called, like leafers? Or the people
Leaf peepers.
Leaf peepers?
What? I think that's
You mean like people that come in to like see the leaves?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I meant perverts who hang out in trees.
Oh, no, I meant the people looking at leaves.
I'm sure we have both. I'm not as familiar with the latter,
thankfully. Because I just made it up.
Well, I'm sure it's a thing. But we have people that come in from different states to see the leaves. But honestly, like where I live is... I don't know. I don't notice it because I live just outside of Boston and there aren't, you know, many trees. Like there are trees, but it's not like, wow, look at this lush orange forest. It's more like, look, there's a tree there. And then in a mile, there might be another tree.
Yeah.
Fair. That's how we have here.
Yeah. But like around where I grew up, like that's like leaf peeping territory. Like, you know, it's...
now it sounds perverse.
Leaf peeping.
Yeah. Leaf peeping. I grew up in central Massachusetts, and I grew up in Framingham until the second grade, and then I moved to Sudbury. And historically, Sudbury is known as one of the early Revolutionary War towns. I believe it's very close to where the shot heard around the world happened in the Revolutionary War. And I like to joke that, like, it's famous for, like, you know, stuff from the Revolutionary War, and then nothing has happened since. And we're still like, but the Revolutionary War, you know, look at this statue.
That's I'm from Illinois and we still talk about Lincoln like he's Jesus Christ.
He's buried there.
I think, yeah, like, because it was like in the, this was when it was the place to be in the heyday. And now it's just like where old people that were able to afford it back in the day moved and where incredibly, incredibly rich people move to get like McMansions.
So if you had to give a descriptor for potential readers, what's Farmington Correctional about?
Farmington Correctional is about an inmate named Chuck who is arrested for violently assaulting someone trying to steal his car. And in prison, he gets really big into Jesus, and he has a social worker named Sarah that he talks with once a week. And Sarah is a very nice woman who is just trying to make sure that the people in the prison that she thinks are kind of mentally ill, that she can, you know, watch them and, like, make sure they have the right kind of medication. But as Chuck goes throughout the weeks, he starts to hear what he thinks is the voice of God, and he starts to see things, and he thinks that God wants him to start killing certain prisoners and doing certain things. And the whole novella takes place within the mythos of my Whispering Pines universe, which I haven't really written about at length yet, but it's essentially Haunted Forest in Massachusetts, loosely based off of the Bridgewater Triangle.
So let me ask, you said Framingham, and I know sometimes the names of towns kind of get shifted. Is Farmington a completely different area?
Well, it's funny you should ask. So basically, initially, I wanted to do a version of Framingham, but I'm not really a huge fan of just saying the town name, because I think it's kind of like, it's not lazy, but I don't know. I just think, like, it's so easy to just be like, here is a town that exists in real life, and I'm just going to write about it. It's right. Like, eh. So I try to switch the names up a little bit. So initially, since I was a douche in my early 20s, I called it Farming Tan, you know, like like you had a farming tan. And then, I don't know, when I got closer to my 30s, I was like, oh, that's kind of a jokey name. I don't know if I want to keep that. So I changed it to Farmington, like O-N, because I thought, like, there's probably not that many Farmingtons. And, you know, it can be a stand-in for Framingham. Little did I know, there are a ton of Farmingtons. There's a Farmington, like, Maine, one in Connecticut, I think. There's one. There's even one in New Mexico where there is a Farmington Correctional.
Very oh. good. It's okay. like the yeah. Springfield of names.
Yeah, basically. So it was like, by trying to make a unique name, I ended up making a terribly ununique name, but at least it's kind of, yeah, it's like a Springfield now where it's like, you don't actually know where it is, except I say it's Massachusetts, so you know.
So in using the name that is of a town you knew, what else did you kind of take from your personal life for the correctional? Like, have you ever worked in a correctional facility?
There's a Framingham Correctional. So when I was writing it, I was very much having a nod toward that place. Granted, I think that is a, like, that's like medium security. That's like, I don't think there would be, I mean, there might be like murderers in it, but I don't think there's like real heavy duty criminals in it. I think it's more just like, yeah, like people that have been arrested for like pretty serious crimes, but not like cannibalism or serial killers or stuff like that, you know?
Darn.
More just, yeah, just like more like aggravated assault and like, you know, selling drugs and like,
you know, regular boring old criminals.
I mean, not boring, like they're still awful people, but you know, like.
So then tell me, I know that, is it your mother is a counselor?
My mother is a social worker who okay. recently got her PhD.
Oh, wow.
So did you ask her about, when talking about correctional facilities, when talking about some of the people in the story, and maybe kind of thinking what shapes these people and what makes them do certain things? I mean, is any help from your mom thinking like that?
No, I didn't specifically ask her stuff, but from growing up around her, and she didn't, you know, she didn't like talk to prisoners, but she did have about 10 years dealing with at a rehabilitation clinic with, you know, like people that were coming down off of drugs and people that had brain injuries and stuff like that. But like, so I was specifically thinking back to probably her experiences with the people coming down off of heroin or like, you know, who had suffered like car accidents and had brain damage, that kind of stuff.
Okay, so Sarah is not based on her. I'm kidding. No, that much is obvious.
I mean, like, it is and it isn't. It's based on her in that, like, I know, like, vaguely what that kind of character is like. And, like, I think, I'm not a mental health professional, but growing up around that and having that kind of a mind, like, I kind of understand, like, what it would be like. I granted as like a very armchair, you know, social worker, mental health professional type.
Yeah, I like to play that role from time to time.
Of course we like to do that. We do that all the time.
It's kind of how you pass time on the subway is you're just diagnosing people.
Yes, absolutely. Sometimes diagnosing, sometimes just flat out judging. It's fine.
I think that's a lot of life, though. And, like, you know, it's not always great, but sometimes it's important. Like, if you see somebody who's, like, you know, flashing people, being like, that's probably not a well individual, and I should not talk to them.
He's a leaf peeper.
He's a leaf peeper, yes.
He's making us into leaf peepers.
But also the character of Sarah, I was influenced by, I forget the name of it, but there's a Joyce Carol Oates story about a woman that I believe is a teacher in a prison. And it's very similar in that, like, you know, she goes there and she, like, reflects on how violent they are and, like, you know, but she feels, like, relatively safe. And then at the end, there's some kind of a lockdown. And in the case of the Joyce Carol Oates story, it kind of just ends, like, immediately after the lockdown, and it's kind of vague as to what's going to happen. But I guess that stuck with me. Like, God, that's an awful situation to be in as anybody, but particularly as a woman in a men's prison, to be stuck when it's in a lockdown. And, like, I know enough to know that you'd probably have to sign waivers that, like, they would try to help you, but, like, they wouldn't want to be, like, having, like, many, many guards injured, that kind of a thing. So they'd obviously have you sign a waiver saying, like, you know, in the event of some kind of this, you're, like, accepting responsibility.
Yeah, I don't envy. I mean, the people who work in prisons, whether it's, like, writing programs or counseling, yeah, I don't know. I always have that vision of Clarice Starling going into the basement and passing multiple MIGs that, like, no thanks.
No, thank you. I bet it's amazing, though, because I bet there's just, like,
amazing
to be around such, depending on the level of the institution that you're in, like, to see these people in real life and talk to these people and try and find, I think, you know, the skills that people have who work in these correctional facilities. I think the ability to make these people seem like people and, like, speak to them like they're people rather than monsters or the boogeyman, I think is amazing, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I think I have a lot of respect for anybody that would be a prison guard or, I mean, in particular, somebody who would work as a teacher or a social worker or someone of that nature because, like, you know, the prison guards, like, they have weapons and they have training. Like, you know, if this happens, you can do this. But, like, regular, you know, civilians, like, say, a teacher, like, might have a little bit of, you know, self-defense experience, but, like, they're not really prepared if something goes down, so they're kind of just, like, just hoping that things stay calm. And I think it's a media perception, too, though, that, like, prisoners will, like, wild out and try to, you know, kill, like, you know, social workers or teachers, or I think the majority of prisoners are probably just trying to keep their heads down and, like, go about their day and just, you know, keep surviving and, like, dealing with the boredom of, you know, however many years they have to be in that place.
Right, yeah. Guys who have an end date and aren't, you know, permanent residents of the prison, yeah, they can't really ask for more time in that case. Right. I don't think we've actually, have we put it out there entirely that Farmington Correctional is out now? It's on Amazon. You can get your hard copy as well as, is it a digital release as of yet?
Yeah, there's an ebook and a hard copy.
Great.
So I want to shift our focus here. In a lot of your writing, and especially in Farmington Correctional, religion comes up. And the idea in this one is that God is speaking to one of the characters. Like, I don't want to give anything away, but, like, right, God is speaking to one of the characters, or so the character thinks.
That is the conceit, yes.
Right, right. And so my question then for you is, in your growing up or in your life, what's the deal with religion in you? What's going on?
I guess it's a complicated question. My grandfather was actually, I didn't know this until a couple of years ago. I guess he was thinking about becoming a priest until he met my grandmother. And then obviously that went under the bus. And it was just like, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and get married and have a
normal life. Oh, that's nice. That's very romantic.
In terms of how I was raised Unitarian, so that's a unique perspective in that it is technically Christian, but so much of the church, like for instance, Sunday school, we weren't like just going over the Bible. We would go over the Quran and we would go over Hinduism, Judaism. So we'd learn about all the different religions, and it was it's a very tolerant like religion. Like mm-hmm. we would encourage gay people to be members of the church, and we would let Jewish people practice in the church. I guess to finish up real quick, in terms of I make a point to say I'm not an atheist, because atheist implies you don't believe anything. I'm agnostic, which means I don't really believe in the traditional view of God, but I also think that I don't have enough, my perception isn't enough, and I haven't been around long enough, and I don't know enough about the universe at large to know if there is some kind of higher power, and I don't presume to know. So basically, I guess my version of being agnostic is like, I believe in something. I don't think I would ever be able to know what that something is.
Yeah, I think we've talked about it. Everything between like our ghosts episode and our aliens episode, we're kind of on the cusp. We're like, I want to believe.
I'll believe anything.
It's like, I just haven't come across definitive enough proof. There's a really funny Kyle Kinane bit where he's talking about the confidence it takes to declare that you're an atheist, but he's kind of going down his own mental index of like, he's like, ghosts? Probably. Bigfoot? I hope so. God? No, don't be ridiculous.
Exactly. Exactly. It's like, you can't believe in some crazy shit and then not other crazy. You just leave the door open for
potentiality.
All of it. Can we talk about Chuck for a second and how much,
how much
is Chuck yourself? I love the war of the internal thinking of, because I've been there before when I sometimes think crazy shit and then I'm like, wait, maybe this is crazy, and then I'm like, but maybe it's true, maybe this is really happening.
I think legit crazy doesn't question it, right? You just kind of take
I don't know how true that is either, though, because then you have to question what the definition of crazy is, because like, I know I'm manic depressive, and I realize I can sometimes, you know, pull back and realize like, oh, I think I'm a piece of shit because I'm depressed. Obviously I'm not really a piece of shit, or if I am, I'm not that much of a piece of shit. But I guess it depends on the mental I think like schizophrenic probably can't pull it back and be like, this is insane,
right?
Like, maybe, but like
how much then of Chuck is you in this,
or Charles from Miskatonic Music?
how much of Chuck is me? I will say, like, the whole thing about how he isn't a violent person, and then one day like something happens and he just kind of like snaps and like isn't, I think if I was to be a violent person, that would be the way it would happen, because I'm not naturally a violent person, but I think if I was pushed to a certain point, I could become a violent person, and then kind of after the fact be like, holy shit, what happened? But I feel like that's the case for a lot of people.
Right. Like, I mean, I feel that's like being an animal, like a person isn't.
Yeah. Animal, I feel like a lot of that is like, you know, like a self-defense murder, say, you know, like there's just no other choice. And you realize like, well, I'm either going to die or I'm going to have to do something that I never thought I'd have to do. So, but in terms of that, yes. In terms of the whole, like, I'm a huge man that like probably had some kind of like underlying, like severe mental illness. No, that is not me.
So where'd you come up with him? Where does this all come from?
The character of Chuck is kind of a nod to, there's a comic by Ben Templesmith called Welcome to Hoxford that's about this guy who's in a prison who is just like, think of a mental illness he has. It like, he has PTS from like serving in the Middle East. And, you know, before that, his father was incredibly abusive. So he's got PTS from that. And like, so this character in Welcome to Hoxford, he's got like dissociative kind of stuff and schizophrenic kind of stuff. So I was kind of thinking of that. Initially, when I went to write the character, I was like, I just want somebody that would be hearing the voice of God where they wouldn't really question it. Because I think if, you know, you or I were to hear a random voice, we would probably be like, okay, I'm going to go talk to someone because I think I've lost my mind.
Eh. But I think there's a lot of ego in Chuck. I mean, because how fucking special do you think you are that God's talking to you? Right?
Well, I mean, he's, and then also I wanted to be accurate with, I think there are a lot of prisoners that, like, you know, they do horrible shit and then they end up in this cage for many years. And what they do to live with themselves is they think, I'm going to, like, absolve my sins and get, you know, very, very much into Christ. And they do. And it's like a coping, it's kind of like the same coping mechanism a lot of addicts have.
Right. You're replacing one addiction with an addiction to religion or an addiction to some other thing that then it puts it out of your hands. I think that's why, like, AA works the way it does, is then it becomes removed from your hands. Yeah,
and I think it's also comforting, I think, to a lot of people to think, like, well, okay, I'm going to be all right because I have somebody watching out for me. And I honestly think that's fine. Like, if that's something you need to do, as long as you're not hurting anybody with it, I think that's fine. It's just once it becomes, you know, like the Crusades, then you're like, well, maybe let's pull it back a little.
A little. Just a little.
A smidge less torture. Yeah. Let me ask you, the theme of sleeplessness and even, is it somnambulism? Is that sleepwalking? It comes up in both your pieces we're going to be talking about.
I have sleptwalked. If that's the question, I have a history of sleepwalking and it scares the shit out of me. Not a lot. It happens just enough that I'm like, wow, that's unnerving. There's a pretty funny story, actually, about it when I went, the first time we went to Disney World. So we flew, I think I was like 12, and we flew from, you know, Boston to Orlando, and, like, you know, we got back on a red eye, or we got there on a red eye, and, like, you know, we get there late, and we just find some cheapy motel, and we go to sleep. And I wake up the next morning, and my dad's like, do you remember what happened? And I'm like, no. Why? And he's like, well, you got up in the middle of the night and I guess you had to pee. So you walked like however many steps, however many other steps. You must have thought you were still in the house at home because it was like the same amount of steps I would have taken to get to the bathroom at home. And he was like, and I woke up thankfully and you were about to like pee on the wall. So I woke up and kind of walked you into the bathroom. So I was like, oh. Okay, thank you for that.
That same exact thing happened to my college roommate. My first college roommate, although, I mean, he was hammered drunk.
Yeah, Jack, my husband had a roommate that they called Bad Dog because he would get up and pee all the time on things.
Oh, God.
But that was not sleepwalking. That was just being wasted.
Yeah, no, this was very much like I had no recollection of it because I was just asleep. The thing that messes me up about that is, like, when you're asleep, you have no idea what you're doing. So I guess this kind of factored into, like, Chuck, too, is, like, if you're in some kind of disassociative state or if you're asleep and you do something, like, terrible, like, really hurt someone, like, how much of that is on you? I mean, obviously, you'd still be arrested and, like, go to prison or a mental institution or something, but, like, the line is definitely a little blurred in that case because you're not awake.
Yeah, I really like the theme of that moment that if you are in your sleep, and I guess it comes up quite a bit now that people, what's the
Ambien?
Yeah. Mm. When people have these Ambien middle of the night, whether it's like getting up to cook a full meal, I think there's occasional reports of like someone waking up with like their hands around their significant other's throat, that kind of shit. And so in your work, I kind of like the presumption that like if the person's not in charge, then who is? I really like that theme.
Well, because it scares the ever-loving shit out of me. It's like, yeah, okay. It's probably just your unconscious. And, like, you're just kind of like, your brain's, like, doing these weird things. Like, it's still working, but you're not awake. But your brain is still, like, thinking things and perceiving things somehow. However, it works really well for a horror narrative to be like, well, what if it isn't your brain that's, you know, what if you're not steering the ship anymore? What if when you're out, it's something else? And there would be no way to know that either. Like, as much as I think I'm a rational person, if I came to on the street, I would be freaking out. Like, what the fuck happened? And, like, I like that, the fear and, like, the sense of, like, what did I do? Like, because I think anyone who has sleptwalked kind of has that moment when they wake up, like, what happened? Like, and granted, I don't do it that bad. The last one I can remember, I was in college, and, like, I don't know, I woke up like on the floor or something. My girlfriend was like, oh, you just got up and like kind of mumbled something to me, and then you like went to sleep on the floor, and I just didn't want
to
bother.
I had the bed to myself, so I didn't bother.
Yeah, so she was spread out there. Yeah. Well, I'm a sleep talker and a sleep texter.
Oh, right. I forgot about this.
That's what I do. I used to, when I was little, I would turn upside down in my bed so that my head would be at the foot of the bed.
Okay.
And I don't know why I did that. That was like a thing. I'm a notorious sleep talker, texter. I've talked to you on the phone, but that's the thing, is like, you don't know what you're talking about.
Have you ever gotten into serious trouble?
I only talk about funny things. Like, Darren and I had a conversation about Sublime.
Yeah.
One time, that made sense, you know.
When she's conscious, she's usually too embarrassed to talk about Sublime. She has to be asleep.
She's just like, I know that, like, everyone, you know, they're this cliche band, but
and then Lou Dog stayed by his body really until solid. People found him.
But the B-sides, you guys, the B-sides.
So I mean, like, but that is like, what did I say? Sometimes you have to go back and be like, oh, holy shit, who knows what I said?
Right, you're checking your outgoing texts, exactly. And your mom is like, is everything okay?
Yeah, because one of the things that I do, and I've done it with Jackson and my mom when I've texted, is for some reason I call them dude, which I don't call anyone dude. And so maybe that's like a tip off.
Maybe it's like your autocomplete.
The dude,
you're just
in your
going
sleep?
Along.
Okay.
Isn't that a weird thing to do? Because I don't say that in my day-to-day life. Hey, dude.
Totally a plot point in a. I'm just putting it together. But like, if you're writing a piece of fiction and the giveaway is like, she never calls people dude in person, only in text at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Write this, Sean. Write this story.
I mean, it reminds me sort of Session 9, too.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm what I like about, for instance, Paul Tremblay does this a lot, is I like, because I'm, I think, too rational to just, like, outright buy into supernatural stuff. Like, I'll write the story about ghosts, but at the end of the day, I'm like, I don't really believe in ghosts, but I like to play around with, like, well, what if it is ghosts, or what if, and play devil's advocate, what if it's some kind of mental illness? What if it's some kind of disassociative state? What if it's like, kind of like what they did in the new Hill House show, not to spoil anything too much, because that's kind of like in the trailer. But just like, you know, analyzing like, okay, here is this supernatural phenomena. What is a natural way you could explain it? So I like to kind of posit those things and bring them up. So then when it comes back around and it is like, no, it is supernatural, then it's, to me, it's scarier, because it's like you've gone through all the other
right.
things.
Right, you thought logically about it and came out still that it's an illogical situation.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite things about something like The Exorcism or any good possession-style movie is when they do go through the motions, mm-hmm. and there are all these like checklists of the logical assumption of what would actually be going on, and when they run out of shit and they're like, well, I guess it's possession.
For me, I like to go straight for like the Fox Mulder, and I like to go for the craziest shit first.
And assume you'll be right.
Oh, yeah, you're like, it is aliens. It has it starts to. Everything starts ends. With aliens, yeah.
But I think that's a good way to segue, though, into Session 9, is talking about supernatural. Is it supernatural, or is it, you know, just some disassociative or multiple personality?
Natural, but weird. I really dig the theme this week, and even though it is Halloween and we kind of we're not really addressing that directly because it's kind of always Halloween here, all these stories, the New England stories and mental hospitals, as it comes up in Session 9, like, I dig them. We back in the day, we used to talk about like trying to trespass and check out, well, I guess there's occasional tours. Because New York has its fair share of institutions as well.
Yeah. One fun thing about, for instance, we're going to be talking about Session 9. That was filmed at the Denver State Mental Institution, or whatever the specific nomenclature is. Mm-hmm. I knew a couple of people that had broken in. Like, it just was a thing people that I lived around would do. They'd drive down there and they'd, like, sneak under the fence and they'd wander around. And they'd be like, oh my God, there's homeless people that live in there. It's so fucking scary. Like, one of them scared the shit out of me. Or they'd, like, go in and film. And
well, that's what, like, we have, you know, Cropsey down in Staten Island, but, like, you can't break in there. Like, literally, it's just people live there. Like, you'll just become one of those people, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it became such an issue with, like, you know, vagrants and with, like, teenage kids just breaking in to smoke pot and have sex on asbestos or whatever the fuck they ended up doing.
It's more fun that way.
They finally were like, they knocked down a lot of it just so kids would stop going in.
In this, like, they knocked it down 5 years, like, pretty much, like, after this film.
They did, but I would like to add this caveat. They are now luxury apartments.
Yeah, I saw that.
We have that in New York.
Roosevelt Island.
Mm-hmm.
They kept the main building, but now it's just luxury condos around it. It's like the main building, you can see a pool, like, from it. Like,
that's insane. Because here on Roosevelt Island in New York, there is a place called the Octagon, which was a mental health facility that actually burnt down, and now it's a really expensive luxury condo, and they kept the Octagon part, which is the most like telltale part.
Which is the weirdest thing. I just want to know, well, okay, my girlfriend's parents didn't move there, but apparently they were thinking about it, and I'm like, wow.
I mean, it would be good if you were a ghost hunter. I would kind of like it.
Yeah, but you're taking your work home with you every day.
It's true.
There's no rest.
I just think it's so funny. Of all the luxury, like, apartments, condos you could live in, you're like, you know what we should, you know where should we should go?
Where terrible things happen.
That place that's built on the enormous mental health facility that has all the bodies still buried underneath it. Let's move there.
It's like moving into Amityville or something.
Yeah.
It's like, you know what? They have these luxury condos at the Stanley Hotel, and I've heard it's terribly haunted, but it's so nice. It's pretty. It's in the mountains.
So I was looking up this Bridgewater Triangle thing while we were talking about it. Apparently, there's a thing called Thunderbird sightings that happen in Bridgewater. I don't know if this is some Massachusetts thing. It's giant pterodactyl birds. Is this a thing?
It's giant eagles. Oh, yes.
That's less exciting.
Oh, that's like Mothman.
Okay, but one of the explanations is that it is actually just like some kind of prehistoric bird that is still alive that we haven't discovered, because like the wingspan of the Thunderbird is supposed to be some crazy, like fucking 10 feet.
I've never heard of this wing before in my life. And the thought of pterodactyls flying around is really exciting to me.
It's a Native American thing, I think it started as, where it was just a legend of. I think basically the reason it was called a Thunderbird is like they thought that the reason thunder happened was this giant eagle would clap its wings and that would be what caused the sound of thunder.
Oh.
And I think from there, people kind of just like appropriated it to mean like an enormous fucking bird. And like, you know, if you watch like one of those Monster Hunter shows, they talk about it sometimes. Like supposedly one picked up some people's like little toddler and like flew it away or I don't know.
That sounds terrible. I'm laughing, but if it was a real story,
I tried to write a story about it, but I don't think I would ever attempt to again because I realized like it's really hard to make Thunderbirds seem scary unless you actually saw
it's
one.
More just amazing than scary. Like,
yeah,
I'm amazed by this.
You've got to turn it into something more sinister, like the way the Mothman is supposedly the crane, a number of things with red eyes.
Yeah.
Because when I wrote it, it was like a really early story, and it was just like it had lightning for eyes kind of a thing.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
It was a very pulpy kind of story. I mean, it was fun to play around with, but I can't picture ever making it scary unless you did like a Mothman thing where it was like, could be a number of things. It could just be some sort of entity that takes the form of a giant bird.
It's like the Madagascar of the New England, where everything's big.
And I gotta get construction crews in here by Columbus Day, so you got a guesstimate how long?
I've got 4 really good guys. 1 week, we're gone.
That's fast.
I need the job.
So now shifting over to the movie of the week, is Session 9 from 2001. The IMDb synopsis is actually pretty for real this time. It's not crazy. Tensions rise within an asbestos cleaning crew as they work in an abandoned mental hospital with an horrific past that seems to be coming back.
Yeah, I feel like found footage movies have really capitalized on the abandoned mental hospital idea.
Because they're scary.
And they're crazy cheap to make also. Yes. But this was before any number of like the grave encounters or any of those, like, you know, what's the night vision style movies where, yeah, it's a pile of jump scares. But here we have Danvers Hospital that's actually a real place. And we've kind of talked about how, yeah, luxury apartments now. And
they really filmed
now.
It there, yeah. They filmed it on location, which probably also actually does have asbestos.
It probably did.
Yeah, when I was in college, we went into, I don't think it was a special hospital of any sort, but it was like a small community hospital that was shut down. And it wasn't until we were inside that we started realizing that, like, there might be asbestos just everywhere.
Well, we had that explosion in New York a few months ago.
The steam pipe explosion?
Yeah, and it just shot asbestos into the air, and they had to quarantine the whole area.
Oh, I didn't realize it was that bad. Good
yeah,
God.
It was like just liquefied, mystified asbestos in the
yeah.
air.
Welcome to New York. Watch out for asbestos.
Watch out for asbestos.
The city that never sleeps or breathes right.
So this is directed by Brad Anderson, who I think most people would know from The Machinist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That's he seems to have sleep issues, old Brad. Because The Machinist is another one where insomnia plays huge. And yeah, I don't know. As much as I like parts of The Machinist, I feel terrible for
I feel like he wasted a lot by losing all that weight.
Christian Bale went through so much and the movie's kind of eh.
Yeah,
I like the film, but, like, you know, also that was on Christian Bale. Like, I'm sure Brad Anderson said, like, lose some weight. And then Christian Bale showed up like that and he was like, holy, I said lose some weight, not all of your weight.
He also directed about 12 episodes of Fringe and 2 episodes of The Wire.
Oh, I didn't know he did The Wire.
I know. I got excited when I found that out. It's written partly by Brad Anderson, but then also by another star of the film, Stephen Gavidon, who is mostly an actor. And he was in, I don't know if you guys saw it, the remake of 13 Samedi.
No.
He was in that.
I saw the poster, and I was kind of surprised that it just kind of went by the wayside, because I remember it was going
to
be remade.
To do with the actual, like, I mean, except for the idea of Russian roulette, but it's nothing like the original film. There's all this extra shit that's stupid.
That's weird.
And he's also in The Deuce. He's Bernie in The Deuce right now on HBO.
Hello, Doc.
Simon?
You know who I am.
Billy has told me a lot about you.
Billy is a smart boy.
What happened on Christmas night in Lowell?
Use your imagination.
I'd rather you tell me, Simon.
Peter was naughty, Doc.
What did Peter do?
He shouldn't have done it, Doc.
Tell me, Simon.
He scared Mary, Doc. He crept up behind her in the dark. And he scared her.
So it stars Peter Milan playing Gordon, who's a Scottish actor. I guess most recently I saw in Ozark. But he's been in Trainspotting.
Oh, he is in Ozark. That's right.
Yeah, he's distinct. He's a great character actor.
He's from Shallow Grave, too, which I love.
Yeah, yeah.
He did a really great, like, accent in Ozark, because I forgot he was Scottish. Like, that's got to be a pain in the ass to do.
Also starring David Caruso, which is the reason I didn't like this movie the first time I watched it.
Really?
Yeah, just that's
really
on me.
Good.
That's just on me.
You gotta have a link in the show notes of that one clip where he's going, fuck you.
Yeah.
He just points at the guy, because that's like,
hey, fuck you.
I see that everywhere.
That's what, like, on YouTube, if you just look up Session 9, that's the first thing that pops up. They're like, the best scene. And David Cruz said, fuck you. Because the camera's not even really very good in that particular scene.
No, like, I love it, but it doesn't help the movie. It's kind of like, I feel like David Caruso insisted on that scene, and Brad Anderson just kind of sighed and was like, fine, all right.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of David Caruso ad-libs that are just kind of generously left in.
I was in Jade, goddammit.
Also starring Stephen Gavidon, who we've talked about, Josh Lucas, who plays Hank. He's recognizable from American Psycho and a bunch of mainstream stuff. Brendan Sexton III, Jeff, who's from Welcome to the Dollhouse and Empire Records and Boys Don't Cry.
And has a wonderful mullet.
Yeah, he does. 13-year-old, though, Mindy, I think, was, like, obsessed
with... Get the fuck out of here.
Listen.
He's so dirty.
Wait, he's so gross in Welcome to the Dollhouse. He's, like, the worst person ever, but I thought he was so cute.
Definition of a dirt stash.
He was so gross, and that's what's wrong with me.
And we've got a fun little cameo by Larry Fessenden, who...
He's in there just long enough.
Yeah, I had to check, but he's just kind of along for the ride. He's not a producer on it. He's just a friend of the crew, it seems.
He just felt like wandering around in asbestos-laden halls.
You know what? I would show up for that filming, even if I was just an extra, though. So I could be there and then maybe sneak off.
Just try not to think about all the shit you're breathing in.
Yeah. That was one thing. And the last time, you know, we talked, Sean, we were talking about, what the fuck was that terrible movie?
Carriers,
they would put the masks on and take them off with no
They wouldn't be over the nose.
Right. Yeah. And this was very similar. They were treating this asbestos cleaning very similarly in that sometimes they had a mask, sometimes they had a full face mask.
Yeah.
Who knew what was
given
happening?
The double fuck yous to mesothelioma.
The basic plot right here, we have Gordon and we have David Caruso, and they have been hired to bring on a team to remove asbestos from this institution. And that's what gets everyone here.
Yeah. It's
what a great job, except for the asbestos.
Yeah, I mean, if you could just wander around with cameras, more fun, but they've actually got like 2 weeks of work to do in 1 week, or I guess actually three weeks worth of work. In 1 week, which not for nothing, but like they go home as soon as it gets dark. I'm not sure when they ever planned on finishing this job.
I also wondered, they don't seem to be the best workers because they fuck around a lot too.
Yeah.
I think that's great though, because it explains why Gordon is so like stressed and why he's like, no, we can get this done. And like why he kind of takes it upon himself, like, even almost like despite his crew, he's like, we're going to finish this even if I'm just the one that fucking finishes this.
Right, because at the very beginning when they're giving the quote, David Caruso's like, this is going to take 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And then Gordon's like, no, why are you doing that, Gordon? You just get paid more money.
Yeah, but he knows he might not get the bid if he goes too high the way he has in the past.
He says it'll take a week because he needs the gig and like he's desperate for the money. And, like, he knows that the guy might give it away to someone else who has a bigger crew who might be able to do it in, like, 2 weeks.
And a lot of the production design in the movie was already there. I mean, we didn't have to do much to sort of enhance the locations.
I think that's also, like, the sort of achievement of the movie is some of that, you know, the paint crawling off the walls and all those different things. And we were just, like, all of the different equipment that's in the movie, it's all just there, if you were there when it was still there. I mean, it was as if 5,000 people had walked out of a building and left all this equipment, and it slowly just sort of decayed, and totally amazing location.
And sometimes also we still would find some samples, some slices of, you know, like some tissue samples or whatever it was, or blood samples. And a lot of the stuff I felt like, well, maybe we should not be touching it. Who knows what we're dealing here with. But it was crazy and super interesting to see what was still in the building.
So as far as the filming goes, only three rooms had like set dressing to it. It turns out they pretty much used the hospital as is. And because they were shooting on digital, they could use a lot of natural light. I think the only place the digital hurts them a little bit is in the darker scenes in the basement, where like this is still early digital for film, and so you get extra grain, you get some discoloration, but other than that, like, it's a really good, lush movie. Some of these rooms are like simultaneously frightening, but really you want to like take a closer look at everything that's on the walls.
And I think like when you get in there, because it's shot with the digital stuff inside, it seems rather small. Everything is kind of small.
You thought so?
But when you get outside, I think it's huge. Yeah, you know, you see these big, huge, I mean, before like a drone footage, you're getting these really great flyby pictures of Danvers, and then you get inside to some of these teeny tiny cells.
Yeah, yeah. And in the like long hallways and all that shit, it's exactly like the Fear Factory kind of setting, where there's a wheelchair at the end of a hall, which I'm sure some dick teenage kid is just like, I'm gonna put this right in the middle and people are gonna freak the fuck out as soon as
and
they
I
see
would
it. Sure.
I mean, it's probably, I mean, the reality is probably worse than that. It's probably some junkies were banging on it.
That's probably
and true. Then they're just like, oh, hopefully there was a teenager that did this. Cut to like some homeless man just like, I'm peeing all over this wheelchair.
Yeah, what they don't show is like all the needles littered on the ground and stuff.
Yeah.
Probably.
God, yeah, the fucking trail of dirty needles.
And none of the characters ever react like, oh, it stinks of piss in this room.
It's true.
Which it would.
Well, in theory, they have masks on and they're trying not to breathe too hard because of the asbestos.
Yeah, but they have masks on like 1/4 of the time.
I mean, this gets into, though, like, it is a movie. Like, I do the same shit, though. I'm like, this is so stupid they don't have the mask on. But then it's like, if they only wore the mask all the time, it'd be so hard to pick up the audio. And then, like, you
it's
wouldn't
true.
Be able to
I
see
mean,
them expressing. And
but that would make editing so much easier.
It would, because everybody would just have a mask on.
Be ADR'd entirely.
Actually, yeah, the ADR would be much easier.
I know this is difficult, Mary, and that's why we're here to help, okay?
I miss Peter. I miss him so much.
Mary, I want you to try to remember what happened 22 years ago on Christmas night in Lowell.
That's where we grew up.
Yes. Can you tell me what happened that night in Lowell?
Nothing happened.
Mary, something did happen. That's why we have these sessions, to help you remember, so you can get better, okay?
No. No, I can't remember.
File note. Patient is showing extreme agitation. She is putting her fingers in her mouth. Mary? Mary?
Have you seen our doll, Mr. Doctor?
Who am I speaking with?
Mary got a china doll from her mommy, and we can't find it now.
No, Princess, I haven't seen it. Maybe Billy knows where your china doll is.
Billy, silly.
Princess, tell me what happened on Christmas 22 years ago in Lowell.
So what we find is, originally, when Gordon goes in, Gordon's the one who hears the voices first. Like, they are whispering in his ear voices.
No, he's the first one that starts hearing stuff, but I think that, you know, they have to establish that he's desperate for the job and he's desperate for the money, because otherwise any sane person would be like, screw this, I'm getting the fuck out of here.
I think I would be more intrigued by it, and I'd keep going and see what would happen, which
well, but
would
then
lead
you would
to
be
my
Gordon.
Demise.
Like, you would literally be that guy then, like...
So then my next question then, Mike, one of the guys on the crew, he's the one who first finds the reel-to-reels and starts listening to them. Number one,
this is the gold mine.
I could never load a reel-to-reel, so I would just be like, don't know what this is. I would probably think it was video, because I'm stupid.
You're holding
like that.
It up to the light.
I'm like, this doesn't look like anything. But I would keep listening to that shit. Mike is like the smartest person there.
Oh, I would too, but I would definitely take it off-site.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
I'd be like, let's take
this away. I think that stuff's
away.
Heavy.
It might
reel
be really,
to reel is very heavy.
Yeah, but
it
they
might be very heavy.
They've
yeah.
got a bunch of carts and equipment that they're moving out all the time. So especially that, like, he's fucking off on the job.
That's true. He is doing the least amount of work, and none
yeah,
of them are
saying?
Doing
like,
much.
Oh, I'm going to clean that room again just myself. Yeah,
yeah. The tapes I liked a lot. Mm-hmm. I think the first time I watched it, I was kind of ambivalent, but I did like where they went with it this time around. And I think by now we've kind of, it's become a little bit of a cliche, the idea of a therapy session recorded and, you know, these multiple personalities presenting themselves. Now it seems almost kind of hack, but in like 2000, 2001, yeah. like this was, it was pretty well done.
I like it. I think it's, and the voice work is pretty good. It's really creepy.
Is the therapist supposed to sound exactly like David Caruso? Is it David Caruso doing the
voice? I don't think it was, but I can't. I don't know for a fact.
I mean, it would kind of make sense if you want to really read into it, like that it would be someone similar to David Caruso.
Yeah, like a moderator.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but yeah, probably not. He's not credited for it on the IMDb page.
Because while David Caruso's character is a dick, there is actually validity to why he's like that.
Yeah.
And
he is the dickish voice of reason, basically.
Exactly, exactly. It's like you don't like what he's saying, but you kind of need to listen to what he's saying.
Clarissa, Mary got a pretty China doll, and Peter got a big old knife.
Then what happened?
Mary's mommy and daddy went to sleep, and then we played upstairs. Peter turned off the light and hid, and Mary tried to find him.
Who played upstairs, Princess?
Mary and Peter. And me and Silly.
Has Billy told you what happened next?
Billy only tells me nice things, Mr. Doctor. Like that I'm pretty.
Princess? Was Simon there that night?
Simon? Well, I don't know any Simon.
Billy's never told you about Simon?
No. I'm tired, Mr. Doctor.
Maybe Billy would like to talk now.
Billy's asleep, Mr. Doctor. He's asleep.
So leading into that idea of these therapy sessions, and I guess one of the cases that kind of brought down the hospital in terms of lawsuits, they talk about hypnotic regression therapy.
Bad stuff.
Yeah.
Not successful.
And they, I guess here, they do treat it with a healthy amount of skepticism. They sort of give the full story, even though it's a made-up story. But it's based on these actual accounts that I guess we've talked about on the show as being this sort of trend in like the late 70s, early 80s, kind of simultaneous with the Satanic Panic era. Mm-hmm. And in this case, like, they're giving rise to these voices and personalities and these terrible events. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I've been thinking about the Satanic Panic quite a bit. I'm listening to a podcast on West Memphis 3 and how much that was like a cultural reaction to the Satanic Panic and this like over the top, vehement sensitivity to like anything that could be bad. So like,
which,
you know, kids
still
in Metallica t-shirts.
Is why I have a thing for, like, makes me a little angry thinking about Oprah, because she really fed into that Satanic Panic.
Yeah.
And everyone
yeah.
forgets that.
God damn it,
Oprah. It's going to sound weird to say. I mean, now that there's distance, I love the Satanic Panic thing because it's so, you know, ripe for like just plucking from it to like use for a story.
Yeah.
If you're going to set something in the 80s, I mean, I feel like we haven't really gotten anything, you know, fiction that has really approached that and like done justice to like this amount. You know, we got like stuff like The Witch, which sort of deals with that, but not in the 80s.
I think it's hard, though, to think back on it now, like knowing what we know now.
Yeah, I guess it's true,
though. So much more information is available to us nowadays that we would just be like, Snopes. Nope, no thank you, that's not real.
That's true.
You know?
I think one place that did it well, and I am a huge X-Files nerd, so I'm obviously partial, but I think the X-Files used Satanic Panic and had a couple of really good episodes that basically dealt with that kind of a thing.
Yeah, there's that early episode. I don't remember if it's in the first or second season, but the teachers who all belong to the same cult, and they are like run-of-the-mill suburban types, and they just, you know, at the end of the night, they kind of close it down with the satanic ritual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think because the first time I watched this, I kind of said I was ambivalent towards it. I wasn't that wild about it. I think the sound design threw me off. It's the one thing I still... It's my one last complaint that I have about this movie. It's that sometimes it's kind of over the top. There's a couple like stock women screams that I've heard in other movies and even other like sound effects collections.
Yeah.
And when those are mixed into like, you know, generator noise and stuff like that, it's a little indelicate. Like, it's a little frustrating that it kind of distracts from what is like a pretty authentically creepy atmosphere.
I mean, I think you have to go back in time with your brain a little bit and say, okay, 2001, this is what we had for independent horror. It was either like this, which was amazing compared to some real garbage with no budget, no nothing. So like, I know it's unfair to say that because it should be timeless. It should be this or that. But like, horror is one of those where sometimes you do have to put your like past hat on and say, comparatively, this was awesome in 2001.
Yeah. Like that mullet.
Listen,
that mullet is out of time.
I like, don't understand. They're all wearing crazy clothes, and I don't think 2001 was that long ago, but it seems like their fashion sense was like 1992.
Yeah.
I mean, but you think that, but like 2001, like, I don't know. If you look at anybody in pop culture in 2001, for instance, you laugh at what they're wearing.
That's true.
Yeah.
It's like a lot of frosted tipped hair and stuff. So it's like they didn't have that, at least.
Yeah. And that was like the trendy of the time. Whereas these guys are just kind of like blue collar.
Yeah, they're not supposed to be minimum trendy. Wage they're type just worker. Like, I mean, they're cleaning asbestos, so they don't care that much how they look.
So speaking of Jeff, the guy with the mullet, Brendan Sexton, he is afraid of the dark, and that's one of my most favorite scenes. Where it does get a little grainy in those scenes, unfortunately, because of the digital filming. But I love a good afraid of the dark person in a film.
Yeah, and they really maximize both the like terror in the dark, being stranded, and then like gasping for air and getting a face full of, you know, white dust in that scenario. Ugh. That was fucking horrifying.
Yes. And the reason that Jeff has to be there, though, is because David Caruso and Mike are like conspiring at that time. And they know that Jeff can't handle the dark. They know he's scared of it. And they're like, fuck him. Let's talk about Gordon. And they're like gossiping while Jeff is now being forced to relive or live his most worst fear.
Yeah, I like all the characters overall. Like, the cast is solid. I really liked all the stories that they got. There's not anything overplayed. I like Josh Lucas's character. Like, it builds nicely where he starts with the scratch-offs and he winds up hitting the like secret brick lottery, the coin slot that pours out these vintage coins that he's essentially followed a breadcrumb trail to.
Right. And he's like reading the dates. Do you know anyone who actually collects coins, either one of you?
No.
In films, people do this all the time, but I've never met a real person who does this.
It's pretty old fashioned. Yeah. As a hobby. Right? Like, I think at this point,
I know an old guy who said he used to collect coins, but he doesn't have them anymore. So it did used to, you know, he said there used to be like clubs he would go to where they'd be like, oh, I collected this coin or whatever. I mean, they had less to do back then.
I suppose that's true.
This was not back in the day. This was like 2001. So it might be a little suspect.
Right? I was just like, I've never actually met a person who did that. I know one of my grandfathers collected stamps, my great-grandfather's.
Yeah, mine too.
But now thinking about any person that's not old or dead,
the pop figures are now that's what people call it.
Oh,
except those are fucking huge. I don't understand how people are amassing these giant collections of pop
I feel dolls. Like we don't collect as much in our generation.
Well, who has the space, especially
everything's
in the city?
Going to digital.
That's true.
Yeah, I remember, and this is going back probably at least 5 if not 10 years, but there was some crazy statistic about, you know, going back 5 years, kids 5 years old and younger will never own a physical piece of media, you know, in terms of like a book or a CD.
Or a cassette single.
Or a cassette single. but so about that moment where he pulls the brick out and it's slot machine heaven and it's dumping out. Like, I think we as the audience, like, that's a thrilling moment at first. And then when you see everything on the floor, you start realizing what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see more than just coins, that moment, that fucking creeped me out. When you start recognizing the, like, oh, this was some horrible hospital stash, you know, some orderly who is just like robbing right. the people there. And it, we find out later, but like everything from gold teeth to glass eyes, like all the creepy shit. The lobotomy spike.
Right.
We haven't even talked about lobotomies yet.
No, we haven't. But let's go for that, because then there's a scene with the lobotomy spike thing where Mike thinks he's being really fucking funny. And he's playing a joke on Jeff.
With the chopstick, yeah.
Yeah, and pretending like he's giving Jeff a lobotomy. That's not... Don't do that to me, ever.
I was surprised that Jeff stood for it. He eventually...
I think he was afraid he was going to get poked in the eye.
Yeah, no, that's
I think he was afraid if he moved that he was going to get poked in the eye.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he goes into detail about the process, which...
Yeah, I was like, you know an awful lot about this for an ex-lawyer.
Yeah, we talked about it pretty extensively. For listeners who haven't checked out the back catalog, when we covered American Horror Story Season 2, I think we did two episodes on it, yeah. because it's a deep dive, but we talked about the invention of the lobotomy and how it actually did... let's see, I've got some details here. Walter Jackson Freeman, who is kind of the grandfather of lobotomies, he was a doctor in the 30s, and he popularized the lobotomy as like a cure-all. By the end of it, they were lobotomizing children.
Right.
And it was just kind of, I think Rosemary Kennedy
yes, that's
was
right.
a famous
Rose
instance.
Kennedy, where, and the thing is that people did not need to give consent, especially if you were a woman. You did not have to give consent. Your husband could just drop you off, well, get it done, and bring you back.
If you've got a better cure for hysteria, I'm all ears.
That's right.
It always involved things getting shoved into things, yeah.
Yeah, no, that Walter Freeman eventually, like, he took the show on the road. He drove around in a lobotomobile.
Well, the joy of the lobotomy is you don't need a lot of tools.
Yeah.
For brain surgery, it's rather easy.
It is the Jiffy Lube of brain surgery. It is
Jesus Christ. Lobotomobile? Oh, my God.
The lobotomobile. That's yeah. right.
There was a famous
this
instance.
It has like a little jingle, like like the Ice Cream Man, but for lobotomies. He's like, come on, kids. Yeah.
There was a case, one, like, of course, he botched a ton of them. Because these were oftentimes like public spectacles as well. And there was a moment.
Are the victims going to be able to say what happened? No.
Yeah. Well, in this case, it was on camera. There was a moment where
Oh, wow. That's dumb.
He like stopped what he was doing to pose for the camera and then went on with it. And I think this was one of the children, one of the like, it might've been like a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
But like these cases are pretty well documented because it happened in the fucking 30s. It's not like science and medicine were new concepts, but here he was sticking shit in people's eyes.
They're like, all right, so just give this kid a ton of cocaine and then we're going to stick this needle in his eye.
The craziest thing is like, yeah, I'm doing basically blind brain surgery.
Yeah.
And just feeling around and hoping that I'm going to poke the right area.
You hope that like, oh, it got a little tough there. I hope that was the synaptic nerve. Well, fingers crossed.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no x-rays.
I honestly think it was just like, as long as I poked the brain, something's going to happen.
That's true.
Yeah, I guess on a bunch of people, they weren't effective. So yes. like they had to go back for double lobotomies. That's, we're living in the best times now these days, you guys.
I mean, it's better than lobotomy times. That's
I guess debatable. The only thing that, like, the only side effect, I mean, besides your brain not working anymore, was that you would have a black eye. So, like, you could get it done, and no one would really know.
Well, didn't...
They just thought you had to be told twice.
I mean, they would probably know when you tried to talk. You're just like grapes, and they're like, what?
Right.
And like, hi.
Rose Kennedy, wasn't that shit done like without her mother's knowledge?
It's
like
true.
they kind of kidnapped her yes. and did it to her
yeah.
without consulting the rest of the family.
Yeah, the father did that. It was because she was kind of like wild. She was a wild child and she would sneak out and they thought she was just going to bring scandal, which is fucking rich coming from the Kennedys. And
this is before they knew their yeah. long and sordid
Isn't that
legacy.
Insane? And so, yeah, so they lobotomized her without even telling the mother, brought her back into the house, and then from the lobotomy, she got real fucked up.
She's like, something's different with Rose. I can't put my finger on it. Is it the drooling?
Yeah, she became completely like in either vegetative state or then would have these crazy bouts of like aggression and violent outbursts that obviously she couldn't control because someone had scrambled up in there. And she was pretty much institutionalized for the rest of her life and hidden away from the rest of the family.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really sad. It's just, I mean, I've been making jokes, but it's just because I don't even know how else to process how profoundly sad it is that we used to have these people that just legitimately needed help, and our solution was we're going to dump them in freezing cold water, we're going to shove spikes into their eyes, we're going to electrocute them.
Well, that's the thing is, I think, you know, even more, I think, profoundly sad now is that not in the United States, but in some countries, they still do electroshock. And there's a version that they actually still do in the United States
well. Yeah, they still do.
And it's like, if you look at the statistics, more than not, and same with lobotomies, it's women that it's being done to.
Yeah.
You know, and so you're thinking like, Jesus Christ, people. Like, right. We live in modern times. Women? What is it? Why do they deserve all the shocking and the poking?
In summation, the reason I think it fits well thematically with my novella is, in terms of the look of Farmington Correctional, I think in the beginning lines of the book, I say this, but it looks like an old Victorian, you know, institution. And I very much pictured like a Danvers State, except as a prison, when I was thinking of Farmington Correctional. And I think in terms of the look, like, there's very much an old New England kind of look to institutions, which is very creepy.
Yeah, it's there just, actually is, because it was the same architect that did almost all of them up and down the East Coast.
Oh, really?
And so they have this very specific style where there's a central one and then the two wings out from there.
Yeah.
Which I also think of like Shawshank. Whenever I think of these old institutions, in my mind, it's that Shawshank idea.
But it's just very like gothic and... Mm-hmm. I don't know. Nowadays, you would never, like, if you know, new prisons, it's just, like, just concrete and, like,
boxes. Blocked. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a box. But, like, back in the day, it was, like, there were parapets and there were, you know, like, little bat wings going off in terms of the structure. And so I very much pictured that in terms of the look of Farmington Correctional, because I said that it was built in, like, 1905 or something.
Right. In my mind, it was like Shawshank, that idea of it. I think also it ties in Session 9, just the way that I feel about it, the general like feeling where I always remember this movie and I go, I like this movie, but I don't remember when I first watched it. I didn't remember exactly the theme or anything. I just remembered I liked this film vaguely. And to me, that fits in so great with your flash piece, 3 a.m. Orphan. Because it's all about these vague ideas that you can't really quite put your finger on when you first saw it. Who told you this item?
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I'm proud of the story. It took a couple rewrites to get it down. But essentially what I wanted to do was play around with the nature of storytelling in general, because so often in a horror story in particular, you will get like this man or this woman who tells this story and you take it as gospel because it's easier in a narrative form to just assume that this person has all of the information and they are correct.
Mm-hmm.
And the only flip you would get would be at the end. It's like, oh, it's a twist because they said it wrong. But I wanted to play around with the fact that like the entire thing might be wrong because it's all so subjective, because it's all going from one person's interpretation, one person's memory, one person's head. So that's what I wanted to play around with the story. And I also wanted to get into kind of like a creepypasta, urban legend-y kind of territory.
Yeah, it kind of has that sort of engine at the heart of it, that this is the origin of an urban legend.
Mm-hmm.
And you can never really nail down, like, you know, everybody kind of treats it. Everybody kind of puts their own spin on it, whether it's like, oh, the narrator was this, or the family that it happened to was that, or the kid was, you know, a boy or a girl. It always changes.
It's always changing fit whatever the narrative you want to portray is.
Game of telephone.
Exactly.
On the internet.
I thought, you know, 3 a.m. Orphan to me is one of those stories that it is like the origin of an urban legend that you would eventually find in stories, scary stories to tell in the dark. That's what it reminds me of, is one of those kind of stories.
In terms of the story itself, it is very much that. The only difference being that, like, it's kind of a deconstructionist story or a meta-narrative where you're getting into the mechanics of story and, like, just pulling apart. For instance, in a regular story, it might be like, I have this friend and he is this age and we talked in my house, which looks very much like this, while drinking cognac about this. But what I wanted to do was you pull all that apart. Well, I have this friend and he might not be a he might be a she. And then you're thinking of all the ways you would write it as you're like pulling it apart, which is very much like, you know, from a writer's perspective, like, oh, well, if it's a man, it has a certain kind of vibe it's going to have. Or if it's a woman, it's got a certain kind of vibe it's going to have. So if you strip all that away and you're not sure which it is, it kind of takes out the mooring and it takes out the grounding of the story.
Yeah. And written in the second person, it kind of, you're not in like any sort of skeptical mode. You're just kind of having this experience the way you would have, you know, a faint memory.
Yeah.
So 3 a.m. Orphan especially struck me as like a kind of perfect story for an audiobook. And I know on your SoundCloud page you used to read some of your own stories and some other people's stories. Is that something you keep up?
I haven't recorded one lately. I'm not against recording it. It's really just been a time constraint thing. And honestly, like, an, I guess kind of like a monetary restraint, where it's like, if I write something now, I can put time in and get, you know, a flat rate of $40, or, you know, get, if I spend a lot of time, I can get royalties from it, maybe equaling, you know, whatever. Those I just don't make money on, because there's not really a way I found that I could make money on them yet. I do them for the love, but I do them, you know, when I feel like it, when I have the time.
Okay, why don't we do one more round of mentions? Where can people find you, Sean?
Well, recently, unfortunately, I finally closed down SpookySean.com. Uh-huh. It was many, many years of keeping up that blog, and I still plan to archive it and have it available as a free WordPress blog that I will link off of my newest website, which is SeanMThompsonFiction.com.
Which looks nice, but, by the way. It looks very lovely.
Thank you. It's very stripped down. I wanted just a very like simple, clean website. So I wanted to, you know, my writing's kind of taking off. So I wanted to have just a very stripped down, like, here's my bio, here's a link to stuff, there you go. And you can find me on Twitter at SpookySeanT. And my books are available on Amazon. Too Late, my chapbook, which is more classic horror, is available in digital and physical. My bizarro novella, Hate from the Sky, is available in digital and physical. My first novel, The Demon, is available digital, physical. And my newest novella, Farmington Correctional, is also available in digital and physical. And that is from Planet X Publications, which has recently put out the Test Pattern Anthology, and they're doing another Test Patterns Anthology, Creature Features, which is coming out soon. So pick up work from Planet X, because they're good guys.
Cool. And so if our readers do track down your work on Amazon, make sure to write a review. It goes a long way in terms of spreading news about the books.
Yeah, if you read one of my stories and like it, hell, even if you don't like it, leave a Goodreads or an Amazon review. I appreciate it.
As for us, I think our only specialized Halloween stuff is actually going to be on our Patreon.
It is going to be on Patreon. I'm very excited about our Patreon month. Episode.
Our newest episode will be up soon. Our last episode, we talked about cults and the latest season of American Horror Story, now on Netflix and Amazon Prime, Cult. Mm-hmm. But yeah, otherwise, we're all over social media. Should be able to find us pretty easily at Rants Macabre on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
Right.
And while you're at it, you could drop us a line. Our email is therantsmacabre@gmail.com. And our website is therantsmacabre.com, where we've always got a couple bonus features. I think when we did the end of the world stuff for our 150th episode, we did a pretty extensive commentary session for The Happening, which, yes, I trimmed down substantially for the best of moments. I don't know. I like to think it's more entertaining than The Happening.
I also like to think that because The Happening is fucking awful. But since it's coming up to be Halloween, Sean, Darren, what are you guys doing for Halloween?
The New York Horror Movie Group is having their annual Halloween party. I think, well, for those who might be hearing this, there's a spoiler. I think I'm going as half transformation werewolf. Oh, I think I'll be... So I've got a suit jacket and a set of clothes that have bullets and blood and all this stuff from previous
fancy werewolf.
Zombie. Well, in the previous years, it was part of my zombie costume, but I kind of want to make use of it because otherwise it's just a crime scene hanging in my closet.
Fair.
So I figured, hey, I'll be a transformational werewolf. Probably, I guess, coming down after having taken all the damage. I don't know. I'm building a narrative.
Okay, yeah. You'll have to work on that. How about you, Sean?
Leaf peeping. Nothing but leaf peeping. I lied before. I am a leaf peeper. Not the good kind either. The bad kind that stares in windows. No, I'm probably just going to be staying at the condo and handing out candy. And I look forward to doing very little because there's been many Halloweens where I have, you know, I've done stuff because everybody wants to have stuff on Halloween for some reason, which I'm going on record as saying I'm not really for. Have it the weekend before, not on Halloween.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think this year Halloween's like on a Wednesday. Yeah,
I went and saw a few years back Nevermore, which was a play that Stuart Gordon did with Jeffrey Combs all about Edgar Allan Poe, and it's basically Jeffrey Combs as Edgar Allan Poe doing this like monologue.
Nice.
Which was excellent, but the only time they were going to have it in Boston was on Halloween. And my girlfriend got so mad because I was like, I can't miss this. They're never going to have this again. I don't think they're going to tape it either. So I made it a point to like stay home and like do the traditional like home Halloween stuff, like handing out candy to the kids and like carving pumpkins and watching horror movies and then inevitably saving a bag of candy for myself that I don't need and eating all of it in one sitting.
Yeah, we bought candy and then we're like, maybe we'll leave the light on. But right now we've just been eating a bag of candy.
Here's a pro tip, life hack. What you do is, you know, you go on the one trip with the partner and you hear this is a candy for the kids. And then secretly you go on another trip and you get the stuff for yourself and you hide it in the basement or wherever. And then you come back upstairs and you're like, oh, wow, I guess the kids didn't take all that much candy. And you have like three full bags of candy and they clearly know what you did, but it's too late.
It's they too late now. It's already in the house.
It's too late in the evening. There's no more kids left.
All right, so that'll do it for me. This is Darren signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.
And this is Sean. Thank you for listening. And have a happy Halloween.
His hair was perfect.